I'm Scott Hansen, host of NFL Red Zone. Lowe's knows Sundays are for football. That's why we're here to help you get your next DIY project done, even when the clock isn't on your side. Whether that's a new Filtrete filter or Bosch and Kobalt power tools, Lowe's has everything you need to feel like the MVP of DIY. So get it done and earn your Sunday. Shop now, in-store, and online. Lowe's, official partner of the NFL.
At Audi Columbus, luxury meets convenience. Family-owned since 1897, we've built our reputation on trust, transparency, and innovation. Browse our selection online and complete your purchase from home. Then, simply stop by to pick up your keys.
Drive home a new 2025 Audi Q6 e-tron for $499 for 36 months with $5,295 down.
The next generation shops online. Experience the future with us at AudiColumbus.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
See dealer for details. Offer ends 9/30/25.
A two-time world champion and the first Brazilian to win Formula One's greatest prize, Emerson Fittipaldi's legacy is unquestionable. He won the driver's title with Lotus in 1972 and again with McLaren in 1974. Paving the way for compatriots Nelson Piquet and Ayrton Senna to follow in his footsteps. But Emerson's wins weren't without risk.
When I leave home, I think myself, I'm going to be back Sunday or not. But when I arrived at the paddock, I loved so much racing. It was my passion since I was 5 years old. I wanted to be a race driver. And then my mind was focused to perform. I learned in life, luck's going to help you. You cannot go against luck.
Formula One is an extremely safe sport now, but Emerson raced in a dangerous era when fatalities were common. Here on a special F1 Beyond the Grid Legends episode with me, Tom Clarkson, Emo tells me about the time he refused to race in Spain because the barriers hadn't been bolted down correctly. He also talks about leaving Brazil and moving to the UK to pursue his dreams, and why he took on the challenge of forming his own Formula One team in Brazil in the mid-70s. And you'll hear an incredible story about the phone call Emerson received from Enzo Ferrari after Niki Lauda's fiery accident at the Nürburgring in 1976. It's one of many fascinating tales that you'll absolutely love hearing from a true Formula One legend. Emo, it's wonderful to have you on the show. How are you?
Very good, Tom. Thank you very much. Enjoy Formula One as ever. Formula One now is this year's incredible competitive.
Well, we're speaking at the Circuit de Catalunya, but I actually want to talk to you about Montjuic Park, and I want to wind the clock back 50 years to 1975. It was a tragic race, but can we start by talking about the racetrack? Montjuic, you won there, of course, in 1973. What was it like?
It was incredible technical track as a street circuit, very fast, much faster than Monaco, very challenged. You know, we had the jump, breaking downhill hairpin, and then we have a tremendous uphill acceleration in fourth gear, top of the hill, fifth gear, on the street. It was a fantastic track. I love it here.
It was a track of two halves, I've been told. You had the fast bit, and then there was a slower bit. Did that make it difficult to set the car up?
It was very difficult, very technical track. The downhill corner, most of the corners was understeering because you were going braking downhill, and uphill corners, you had oversteer. And they were always difficult to get the best compromise from slow to fast corners. But it was an incredible track to drive, really fun to drive, tough, difficult.
We're going to be talking about safety a lot in this track. You won there in 1973. What was your attitude towards the safety of the track that year?
Well, I was jogging on Thursday. I always, every street circuit that I race, like Long Beach, all the new street circuits, I used to jog before the official practice to see the bumps, the surface. And I was jogging. I looked to the protection, the guardrail. And Sam was just standing on the pile with wire, not even a bolt. And then I look again, and there was most of the track all around like that. And I went to the organizer on Thursday afternoon. I said, come on, guys, this is we cannot race like that. We cannot drive here. You know, have trees, public, you know, post lights behind the. How can you race in the street like that?
And what did the organizers say?
They say, well, tomorrow should be done. We are going to work to put all the boats, everything correct place. And they promise tomorrow.
And so tomorrow comes. Had it been done? Had the work been done?
Unfortunately, it was not done. And then was already official practice Friday morning. We start running like that. And I know we are taking a very high risk because at that time, motor race was very dangerous. And I had to accept a level of risk that exists. You know, we knew there was a very high risk, but that was beyond acceptable risk on the street circuit with a technical situation like that.
And was the onus on you as the reigning world champion to call the shots? Or did you have the support of Niki Lauda and the other senior drivers as well?
What I did, I organized a tour around the track with all my colleagues. And there are some pictures. I mean, myself, Niki, James Hunt, Graham Hill, we all walking around the track and we all watching the reality, you know, after the practice on Friday.
This had never happened in Formula One before. How do you go about not racing?
Well, you know, Teddy Mayer was team owner of McLaren. And Teddy was very close friend of Bruce. And Teddy lost his brother, Tim Mayer, at Tasman Series. And that's when he met Bruce. And he took over McLaren. And Teddy knew the risk that I had to accept. I told Teddy, I'm not going to race on this track like this. I cannot accept this risk. Teddy was, you know, very good. He was a lawyer from Pennsylvania, but loves racing. And he looked to me and said, Emerson, if you don't want to drive, don't race. He accepts. Was tremendous pressure. I was defending world champion, dicing for another world championship. Was a very difficult decision. And then there was like a Saturday afternoon was a chaos. With Balestra, the pressure. Then they found out I was not going to race. It was a very tough weekend, very difficult weekend.
Can we break it down? So you've decided not to race. First of all, did you have the support of your fellow drivers?
Was divided. Some drivers said, we race anyway. And some drivers said, and I think the freedom of choice to each individual, each driver, is their own risk. And was myself, my brother stopped, and I think was Arturo Merzario too. The three of us decided, but it was a tremendous pressure because Balestra in the afternoon come to us, to me, to Teddy, not to me, and say, if Emerson doesn't race, we are going to lock the McLaren transport and he's not going to race in Monaco the weekend after. Was Monaco Grand Prix. And then we were trying to find a way. You know, it was a huge emotion for me. It was very difficult because you had all the dealers from Philip Morris globally to have a dinner Saturday night. And they're all excited to see the world champion racing with McLaren next day. And I announced on the dinner, I'm not racing. And it was a tremendous pressure on me, personal, tremendous pressure.
And still, Teddy Mayer, the boss of McLaren, didn't put pressure on you, even with all of those sponsors there.
Ted was a very, very clever, very, he loves the sport. He lost his brother. And he knew that's my decision. How could I race on a track that I feel unsafe? How could I perform? You know, I could not perform knowing that if I do a mistake, I could finish up in a tree.
Emo, you had made your Formula One debut at Silverstone in 1970. How had your attitude to safety changed in the 5 years up to that point? Would the Emo of 1970 have raced at Montjuic in 75?
You know, my first meeting with the Grand Prix Driver Association was in Geneva, Jochen Rindt, Joe Bonnier, and the great Jack Stewart. There was a big, I would say, movement to improve safety. Safety on the racetrack, safety on the driver's equipment, safety on the car, safer rescue team, ambulances, helicopter. And all this starts thanks to Jack Stewart, at that time Joe Bonnier, and Jochen Rindt. I was in that meeting in Geneva. First time I was the young boy coming from Brazil, knowing Formula One 1970. They really welcomed me. I learned with them. And I knew that for the future of motor race, you have to fight. Because many of the organizers that time, many of the promoters didn't care about the driver's safety. They care how they can make money, how they cannot spend money. Mm.
And so when Jackie Stewart retired at the end of 73, was the emphasis on you to continue his work with safety?
For sure. I was full committed. And, you know, talking about Watkins Glen, I was behind Francois when he went under the AMCO. And it was a tragic weekend. And I lost Jochen Rindt, my fourth Grand Prix. I was going through a period of a lot of loss.
I can see it was a very easy decision for you not to race then.
Yes.
In Spain.
Difficult, but I knew why I should not race there. And it was a fight to improve safety in racing. It was already like my fifth year of Grand Prix racing. I lost so many friends by then. Peter Revs, I don't want to say all the names, but in 5 years I lost a lot of friends.
You've mentioned Jean-Marie Balestre, who was the president of the CSI, which would become the FIA. You say he was threatening, and you ended up doing, I think, 3 laps in qualifying, didn't you? I think you were nearly 50 seconds slower than Nicky's pole position time. Why did you do those 3 laps?
Because by rules, if I didn't do these 3 laps, I could not start the race. And we decided to start the race and give only 1 lap and come in and buy. And that's our decision. That's when Balestre heard that he wanted to impound the McLaren transport. And it was a big political issue. Bernie was involved. Bernie was behind me. Bernie said, yeah, this is your decision.
I've read mixed reports from the race about what you did next after qualifying. Some have said that you immediately got in a plane and flew back to Geneva. Some have said that you did the 1 lap in the race. Can you just clarify what actually happened?
No, I had to do 1 lap in the race. I had to do because that's the threat from Balestre. And I started the race. You cannot say that I didn't start. And then I was really very sad, disappointed. And I did 1 lap, went straight to the airport to pick up the first plane to Geneva. I was leaving Lausanne at that time in Switzerland. And I just wanted to go home. I didn't want to watch the race.
So you didn't watch the race?
No.
So when was the first time you heard that Rolf Stommelen had crashed while in the lead and tragically 4 people had been killed?
Well, when I landed in Geneva, there was a Swiss TV from Geneva waiting for me. And I saw that he was going to ask me why I didn't race, you know, what happened. And then he gave me the sad news. I was very sad, very, very emotional to hear that.
So, Emma, what did Formula One and what did the drivers of the time learn from the events that weekend?
Not just that weekend, but we are learning that we have to improve safety globally. You know, in every Grand Prix, I think was a tragedy. Like we lost many other drivers in different situations. But, you know, 4 people from spectators. I mean, I think it was 2 photographers and I think 2 marshals, if I'm not wrong. And there was 6 people injured as well. Altogether, 10 people. It should not happen mid-70s, that tragedy. Thanks to what Jack Stewart started, Joe Bonnier started. Joe Bonnier got tragic killed in Le Mans. Jochen Rindt's first meeting of GPDA. And all the work, the effort that we are doing to improve safety, it shows now the difference. I think every tragedy that we had in Formula One was showing the right way to go for the future. And that the work was not a waste of time. You know, how many times Jack flew to different countries to improve the safe track. I started flying to many different countries before the Grand Prix to watch the track safety, to meet the organizers. I had my own doctor with me from Switzerland. He had a survive kit and was very embarrassed. I arrived, by example, at the German Grand Prix. I went to the chief doctor and said, Rafael Grajares is my doctor. If something happened to me, he'll take the responsibility. If it's a brain damage, you take me to England. If it's a burning, it'll be German. If it's orthopedic problem, Switzerland. I had my own doctor with me and was embarrassed that time. But then he started looking the ambulance, the helicopter, how you can exit. And that was to help me. And the second year cost me so much. Then I shared with Carlos Reutemann. We're three drivers. Then the chance was 30% because he could go to the hospital and the other driver is still racing. But that was, we need to help the rescue team, you know. And sometimes they have nurses on the ambulance, no doctors, some countries.
Emerson, that is an extraordinary story you've just told us, yes. Having your own doctor and having to have those conversations with the medics from the racetrack. Did you do that at every Grand Prix?
I had the document signed, notarized from Switzerland, who had to take the responsibility of myself to be my own doctor. And I give this document to every Grand Prix. And I introduced, was a little embarrassed, but Dr. Grajares, Rafael Grajares, he was from Costa Rica, and he graduated in Heidelberg. And then he was speaking Spanish, his own language, English, Italian, French, and German. And it was, I found him in Heidelberg. He was graduated from Heidelberg University, and he was doing a course in Switzerland. That's when I hired him. I had the president of one of the Swiss hospitals, Dr. Bossar, who started making what you call survive kits. By example, if I had the problem of breathing, they could immediately, you know, make a hole.
The tracheotomy,
Sometimes they didn't have any equipment in the ambulance. And that's how deep we are going at that time.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes. COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
What I find extraordinary about you, many things I find extraordinary, I'm going to come on to your courage later, but all the conversations I've had with people racing at that time, you all believed that it would never happen to you. That is how you justified getting in the car week in, week out. Yet you seemed very aware that it could happen to you. Hence, you had the doctor and you'd given the instructions to go to England for one injury, to Germany for another injury. So how did you square away in your mind the safety aspect that it could happen?
You know, it was very difficult. For example, every time Thursday, Wednesday, when I leave home, I think myself, I'm going to be back Sunday or not. But when I arrived at the paddock, I loved so much racing. It was my passion. Since I was 5 years old, I wanted to be a race driver. And then my mind was focused to perform. And I knew that I was very well organized on every aspect. That if something happened, I would be at that time with good people behind me to help me. I learned in life, luck's going to help you. You cannot go against luck. I'm a guy with tremendous faith. And my grandmother teach me this faith. She ran away from the communist countries when communists arrived in 1927 in Ukraine. She and my mother, my grandfather was official from the Tsar of Russia. And when the communists arrived, they have to run away and immigrate to Brazil. And she was a woman of tremendous faith in God. She passed that to me. And thanks God, you know, I'm today, thanks God every day. I'm here, enjoy talking to you. And it's fantastic, you know. And
if you combine your preparation from a medical point of view, your faith, did you ever have fear in a Formula One car?
I had many times when I lost control. When in a fraction of a second from driving, you are a passenger of the car. I had a few situations that I didn't know if I'm going to survive or not. I was testing a brand new Formula 2 car in Snetterton, calling just finished. It was called Texaco Star, beautiful. First brand new car, I went by Snetterton by the pit. I smell a little bit of fuel, just running first time, brand new car. Second lap, more fuel smelling. And I say, I should stop. But then the smelling fuel same level, and I did a stupid mistake. I didn't stop. Going to turn one, Snetterton, the car blow fire. And as the car blow fire, I went straight turn one on the grass. As the car is still running, I release the belt. I jump out of the car. I have flames on my uniform. And the car burned to the ground. I thought I was going to be killed in a fire at that time, and the car finished. I had a crazy crash in Zandvoort that I was stuck in the car. The fuel tank blow. I was sitting fuel. My feet wasn't stuck in the pedals. And Graham Hill stopped. And Joe Ramirez, who was Jack Stewart's mechanic, saw that I couldn't get out of the car, bring the toolbox running, and took 20 minutes to cut all the pedals, and there was fuel. They are taking my risk. Graham Hill and Joe Ramirez.
That's a wonderful story.
Yes.
Was there a camaraderie among the drivers then that tremendous. Is different now?
Tremendous camaraderie. Because we knew that, you know, it could happen to anybody, anytime. And outside of the cars, we had a great camaraderie. We talk a lot about with the families, it was tough for the families, the wives, the children. It was a very tough time for Formula One, not easy. To be there and knowing that, you know, any time can happen. But it was a glamorous time. I was enjoying, I think, one of the best times of Formula One. I got from 70 to 80. I was enjoying every second.
A tough time to be married to a Formula One driver as well. Your first wife, Marie-Helena, how did she deal with the risks of knowing her husband, in your words, may not come home?
Very good question, Tom. When we just joined Formula One, Betty Hill, Graham Hill's wife, was a fantastic lady. She was incredible. She got all the women and she started talking. And she teach the new wives, the new women involved in Formula One. Betty Hill was fantastic. Like Graham Hill was fantastic. I was lucky to race with Graham Hill.
You seem to have had a very mature attitude when you first came in, because you were a very young man when you started in Formula One. How influenced were you by the elder statesman? Because in 70, you had Graham Hill as your teammate. When you went to McLaren, Denny Hulme was still racing back then. These guys, almost old enough to be your dad. Did you learn a lot off them?
You know, Tom, when I left Brazil, for sure, Jim Clark, Jack Stewart, Graham Hill, Bruce McLaren, they were like the monsters of Formula One to me. And then I remember the first Grand Prix, Brands Hatch, I'm a Lotus 49, one of the last races of the 49. There was Jim Clark's car since 1965. I stopped on the grid, I didn't qualify well. And next to me comes Graham Hill. And I look, I say, I'm starting next to Graham Hill. They are the monsters, and they are incredible people. And Jack Stewart, I'm still a very good friend of Jack. And in 1969, Brands Hatch, Race of Champions, I saw Graham Hill on the Lotus Transport, and I want to get an autograph from Graham Hill, and I was in line, but it was so long line, I never got an autograph.
And you got one, you got one when you were his teammate.
They are my idols, and then I was racing against these guys, and like Danny, you know, Danny Hulme was incredible. I mean, all these, I call the monsters of Formula One to me, arrived from Brazil.
We started this chat talking about Montjuic 75 and everything that happened there. Can we fast forward 12 months almost to Nürburgring 76? One of the questions I asked you earlier was, what did Formula One learn? And I remember we went to Nürburgring and the drivers didn't want to race again, yet everybody raced, including Emerson Fittipaldi. What was different? Why did you race then?
We were discussing about raining part of the track and part of the track dry. How can you have slips or wet tires? Because it can happen in Nürburgring. It's 21, 22 kilometers a lap. And it was a big discussion. At that time, we were concerned about the rescue team. If you crash part of Nürburgring, who's going to rescue? How long it takes to arrive there? And how can you keep the driver alive? And it was a big discussion. And that weekend was a tragic weekend. And what happened to Nicky, I was one of the last guys to stop and help Nicky. And then Dr. Grajares was at the hospital. And I was myself, Maria Helena, at the hospital. Nicky's wife, she was there. And then Dr. Grajares was in and out to give me the news how was going Nicky. They were transferring blood every half an hour to keep up the oxygen because he didn't have... He burns his legs. He didn't have enough oxygen in the blood. They have to keep this. And then I asked the doctor, Dr. Grajares Emerson, 50% of survivors there. And 1 o'clock, Daniela Detto, who is the team manager for Ferrari, said, Emerson, I have a call for you. And I went to pick up the phone. Commendatore Ferrari. Fittipaldi, voglio guidare nel posto di Nicky. Do you want to drive to replace Nick? I say, sorry, Commendatore, I cannot talk this now. I put the phone down. This is part of how I was racing Formula One. It was tough.
That is an amazing story. So Enzo Ferrari rang you when you were at the hospital with Nicky.
And that Daniele called me. I'm a very good friend of Daniele. And then Nicky made a miracle. 47 days later, he was driving Monza. I just put the phone down. You know, it was a shock to me. But that's reality at that time.
Just as an aside, do you regret not racing for Ferrari at some point?
I always loved to drive for Ferrari, like all the Brazilians, like I'm sure Nelson Piquet, Ayrton want to drive for Ferrari. It never happened. First time I met Commendatore Ferrari, 1971, he invited me for lunch. He shakes the hand to me, first time I met him personally, and say, Fittipaldi, come stai Chico Landi? It's a long story. Chico Landi, the Brazilian driver, was the first twin for Ferrari Monoposto in 1948, the Bari Grand Prix that my father was broadcasting live to Brazil. And not many people know that first Ferrari wins in a single-seater was a Brazilian driver.
And that's the first thing Enzo said to you?
Yes. And after I discussed, I was already signed with Colin. I say thank you for the opportunity, but I signed 3 years with Colin. I'm very happy with Lotus. And then I call Mr. Chico Landi in Brazil. I say, I call him Mr. Landi. I say, Mr. Landi, first word of Commendatore Ferrari, how you are doing? He started crying. It was very emotional.
Yeah. What another brilliant story, Emma. Can we talk actually about your courage now? Because when I look at your career as a whole, you showed a lot of it, I think, moving from Brazil to England in 1969, paving the way for other Brazilian drivers to follow you. That took a lot of courage. Not racing at Montjuic, a lot of courage. Going and driving for your own team in Formula One, a lot of courage. And then fast forward to IndyCar doing 240 miles an hour at Indianapolis, a lot of courage. You were unique, Emerson.
No, I think it's the love, the passion for motorsport, always the new challenge. I think in life you always have to have a new objectives, new life, and not many people know, but when I won my first world championship in Monza, I went home to Switzerland in Lausanne, and I had lunch with my father, and I asked both, I want to have lunch with both, my father and my brother. I looked to my father and said, I'm retired from racing. What else I want? I'm a world champion, and all the risk that exists, why I should continue? And my father, very wise man, he looked to me and said, son, I know the way you love racing. In 1 or 2 years from now, you'll be back in the cockpit. It'll be much more difficult than if you continue. And he was right, and I continued.
Can we break down those courageous moments I was just talking about? Coming to England, 1969. What happened when you got off the plane?
There was an Anglo-Brazilian guy called Jerry Cannigan. He's still a very good friend of mine now. Thanks to Jerry, because he raced Formula Ford in Snetterton 2 years before. And he picked me up at the airport on a Mini Cooper. And then we drove to Snetterton Sunday morning. And when I walked at the paddock Snetterton, first time in England, I saw all these different categories of people. I said, this is a paradise for me. You know, it's so different from racing in Brazil. But thanks to Jerry Cunningham. And then Monday, we went to Frank Williams to buy a Titan. And Frank was the dealer of a Titan. And Frank says, sorry, it's going to take 2 months. And then I show my some albums for my race in Brazil. Frank looks, there's race in Brazil? Frank Williams. I say, yes, Frank Williams. But I hardly could speak, but Jerry was introduced me to Frank. He took me to race in
Frank
England.
Was one of the first people you met in England. And then you would run the track with him on the Thursday of a Grand Prix.
Yes, and then
a few years later.
Same year, this was beginning of 69, end of 69, after winning the British Formula 3 Championship as first year, Frank was having flying lessons. I was leaving Norwich, and he came on a small plane with his instructor, land in Norwich and say, I want you to drive next year with Piers Courage. Same year. And he had Piers Courage. It was end of 69. And I say, Frank, thank you, but I'm not ready for Formula One. And calling invite same year.
I'm going to say, 6 months later you were.
Yeah, I was very lucky to be in the right place with always good people behind me. Because you have to be in the right place, good people around you. You don't do by yourself. You always need good people. And Colin Chapman was fantastic to me. He was like a mentor to me. I thanks Colin. And I'm still a very good friend of Clive. And it's fantastic. They're always fantastic to me.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes. COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
There's more from Emo in a moment. And once our chat's finished, why not check out F1's other official podcasts? On F1 Nation's preview of this weekend's Canadian Grand Prix, I'm joined by Jolyon Palmer and Natalie Pinkham to discuss whether the harmony between Oscar Piastri and Lando Norris can continue and whether Max Verstappen will change his approach given he's just one penalty point away from a race ban. And the latest episode of F1 Explains is with Sir Jackie Stewart. Just search for F1 Nation and F1 Explains on your podcast app now. Can we just talk about how much of a courageous decision it was to join your brother Wilson in your own Formula One team, leaving behind a championship winning car.
Not many people know our story, but when I started racing Brazil, I started building carts, mini carts. The factory still exists now, to sell carts to be able to sponsor myself. And then when Volkswagen launched Formula V, myself and my brother built Formula Vs to race and sell to other people. We made the Fit Porsche prototype very fast in Brazil. We made the twin-engine Volkswagen in Brazil that was very fast. We always liked to build cars in Brazil. It was limited. And then my brother left Brabham with Bernie. And he said, why we don't make a Formula One Brazilian team? We can have the package Cosworth, Hewland gearbox. And that was, you know, a great package to build a car. And we decided we start building the first car next to Gate 7 in Interlagos. 100 meters from Gate 7 will be the first Copersucar car. And then we had the sponsorship from Copersucar. And after 1 year, I said, this is a new challenge for my life. I want to drive my own car. But it was so difficult to build a car in Brazil. All the logistic customers, all the bureaucratic documentation to get the engines in Brazil. We, myself and my brother, went through a very tough time. And we got Joe Hamid as team manager at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah,
I saw Joe yesterday.
Yeah, he comes here to the Spanish Grand Prix every year and Hungary.
It was a challenge for me. It was a challenge. I learned a lot. It was very difficult. And the last year, 1980, we had the best people on the team. I had Adrian Newey, first job. Harvey Postwaite was a fantastic design. Peter Ward's team manager was my team manager, Lotus. And then Skol called me and said, we cannot continue. Sorry. The Brazilian press is so criticized against your project. It doesn't justify to sponsor Formula One team anymore. And the fortune, I had Keke Rosberg, my teammate. I called Keke, I said, Keke, we are going to stop. But I learned a lot.
When Wilson was setting up the team, did he think about basing it in England?
We think about the building the cars for sure in Brazil, and then have a base in England, have to have. But we had a big support for Embraer, the Brazilian that was very successful airplane company. We had all the profiles for NASA, because they have all these, have access to the wind tunnel. The 01 car, FD, Ricardo Dívila, who was a brilliant Brazilian engineer, is very aerodynamic. If you look at the 001 car, was designed and developed the Embraer wind tunnel at the airplane factory.
How close were you to succeeding with Copersucar, do you think?
I think 1980, because the Formula One team is not the car you have, it's the people who's behind the team. And it took like 4 or 5 years to get the personnel that we had. It was a fantastic team. I think that our last car, who was the first car for Adrian Newey, was a beautiful car. I only did a few laps in Snetterton. We took to the German Grand Prix, Keke qualified fourth, and I think I was fifth or sixth, but was already competitive from out of the box. And unfortunately, we had to stop at the end of the year.
So you stopped racing as well. I'm thinking back to what your dad said to you after you won that first championship at Monza. How quickly did you miss it and start thinking about a comeback?
Well, you know, we invented a category in Brazil called supercart. Twin engines, 125cc each, directly with no clutch. It was very fast and it was televised to all Brazil. I've got the young guys I was racing with Wilson, and we keep racing, having fun. We call it supercart. It was actually very successful in Brazil, a Brazilian championship. And then a friend of mine who organized first Miami Grand Prix, a gentleman, American Cuban called Ralph Sanchez, called me in Brazil, my office, Emerson, I want you to drive the Spirit of Miami, a March Chevrolet. I never been to Miami in my life. Miami had no appeal for me. And then he said, Emerson, he was very polite, very insist. And I said, why not? I went to Miami. And then I enjoyed driving the Spirit of Miami. It was a fast car. Actually, it was designed by Adrian Newey, the car. It's one of Adrian Yates' design.
Yeah.
March.
Yeah.
Chevrolet, very fast car. We're against the official team from Porsche. From put the car on pole, first time out of retirement. And I said, I'm having fun. I'm going to do a few races in America. And then someone called me to drive in Indy, same year. When I joined Lotus, I keep asking Colin, how was Indianapolis? I was because he won with Jimmy in 65. And Colin loved it. And I asked Jochen, Jochen test Indianapolis. I said, yeah, Jochen, how was Indianapolis? Shit place, I never go back.
Why did Jochen not like it?
He didn't like the ovals, he didn't like the people. Indianapolis, you love it or hate? And then I always had this back of my mind to drive. I had this opportunity from a small team to try Indianapolis. I love it. And then I said, well, I'm going to do a few races in America. I did another 11 years of race. Yeah.
Couple of Indy 500 wins. You win the championship as well. How scary are those first laps at Indy?
Well, I think Indy, you have to have confidence on the car, on yourself. You cannot be scary. You have to respect the limit. You know, I learned a lot with AJ Foyt, Mario, give me so many, all answer. They give me so many advice. Because first thing when I arrive in Indianapolis, I ask them, what should I not do here? And they told me a lot of, if there is any vibration, you feel anything wrong with the car, come in. Don't stay out, because it's not forgiven. And I always respected this. And I did only one mistake in Michigan Speedway. I didn't respect. I had a huge crash. Indianapolis, you have to feel what the car is going to do before it does it. It's a sense of what the car is going to do before the car is losing or understeering, oversteering. You have to have a very final tuning. And it took me like 2-3 years to learn. Not just driving, the setup of the car. You know, you cannot be aggressive. You have to respect Indianapolis. The speedway, super speedway. You have to respect.
And there's a lot of crossover, a surprising amount of crossover, certainly in the 90s with Formula One, because Ilmor were making the Mercedes engines in Formula One and, of course, at Indy as well. Tell us about, I think you call it the Beast.
Mario Illion and the Paul Morgan from Ilmor, they decided to do a push rod engine that was on the rules of Indianapolis and was 1,200 horsepower. It's incredible. The car was spinning wheels in fourth gear.
That's surely not what you need at Indy.
Well, because the cambers, you know, in straight line, you only use a quarter of the tires because the cambers are all offset. When you go cornering, then you have the full contact. But it was an incredible car. And we were sent back in qualifying practice. We only did a half lap and another half lap. Then we knew the lap time because we never want to do a full lap for the people not to be against. But then after the race, the engine was banned.
Was it scary when you put it all together in qualifying?
No, it was fun. It was fun to drive. When you had enough downforce and tried to, we were nearly flat all the way around the four corners. It was a challenge. It was beautiful. When you had to, the car correct to do one lap in Indianapolis at that speed, so much adrenaline, was a fantastic feeling.
I've stood at turn one at Indianapolis for qualifying back in 2019. I know you went there this year, didn't you, to watch the race. When you're a spectator now, is it hard to believe that you actually did that?
Looking from the outside, these guys are all crazy. I was one of the crazies there because so much you saw, Tom, going to turn one, amazing.
You know? Yeah.
At that speed. And that's why if something happened on the track, a small piece of paper, red flag, clean the track because it's not forgiven.
Emo, it's been such a wonderful chat. If we just bring it back to Formula One now, when you look at the current grid, which driver reminds you of you?
I think every driver has his own style, but I think the one that's very similar in one way, and I'm a great fan, is Fernando Alonso, because he's there with the young lions, he's strong, is a lot of age, but mentally strong, physically strong, is there. And I like Fernando a lot.
And that same versatility that you had, because Fernando's been to Indianapolis, he's raced in Formula One.
Yes. I respect a lot Fernando. Fantastic champion.
If he reminds you of you, coincidentally a double world champion as well, just give us your thoughts on someone like Max Verstappen and the job he's doing now.
Well, I think Max is on the level of driving now incredible. He carries now the Red Bull car on his back. He's not driving, he's carrying the car in situations that, I mean, like the Brazilian Grand Prix last year was there. It was amazing what he did. I go back to Ayrton Senna to compare as a driver, styling, you know, similar.
You're such a great observer of racing drivers. When you look at Max, particularly on car, what's he doing that impresses you? Can you see something in his inputs that impresses you?
I think what's very impressive that he's able to utilize 100% of the car full time, of the car performance, of that four wheels that are having the grip, and he knows to keep the balance, to use the four wheels effective, holding the sideways bite correctly. And I think that's very impressive. And breaking to the corners, everything. And he's always on the edge of the balance of the car, of utilizing the maximum grip available in each different situation, braking, turning, mid-corner, exit. You can use the four wheels perfect.
And you're here with McLaren.
It's great to see McLaren back again on top.
Isn't it? And their two drivers, Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri, they're having a good battle. Both are in the championship hunt for the first time. I know some people will argue that Lando had a chance last year. Of course he did, but this is the first time he's really in it from the start. Can you just tell us how difficult it is to deal with the extra pressure that comes with a championship campaign?
They have the pressure for the championship campaign and they have the extra pressure of teammates. You know, it's double pressure. Not just trying to win the championship, but the competition from both. You know, at one point, I don't know when it's going to happen, someone's going to have more points on the championship. And I don't know what Zac Brown, Andrea, is going to do it. You know, I like to leave open situation because that's racing.
But and you're a purist, aren't you, Emerson? You want to see them have equal opportunity. That's the impression you give me.
I think so. They have now open opportunities. I don't know. You know, depends how lucky each one is going to be to get more points than the other and how close the third guy is going to be on the championship. If it's not close, it'll be a fight between both to the end of the championship.
Well, we are going to enjoy it almost as much as I've enjoyed talking to you again, Emo. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
One final one, and it's a question I've asked everybody on the pod this year. The championship is 75 years old. Do you have a favourite moment in the whole 75-year history of Formula One? It can be about your career or it could be something not related to you at all.
My number one idol was Juan Manuel Fangio, the maestro. I remember him and my father was in 1954. I was very young. At the Argentina Grand Prix, had pictures and talking to Fangio, interview Fangio for the Brazilian radio.
Your dad did.
And Florian Gonzalez, El Cabezón. And for me, was my memory of Formula One is very strong because Fangio was one of my idols. He knew since I was a child. When he used to come to Geneva, he called me and he told me his stories. And I was sitting on the table having dinner with Fangio. It was amazing histories.
Is there one race that stands out of Fangio?
I think there were so many wins Fangio had. But most than one race was his style. He's all so precise. I always look at the apex of the corner. He hit the inside wheel exactly on every lap, every corner the same. And that's inspired me to do the same. He was so consistent, precise on his style. And he had a great style of driving. I visualize these pictures, driving the Maserati 250, 1957, the Mercedes. This is all my image.
Emerson, what a brilliant story to end on. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Tom. It was great. Thank you.
I love how Fangio's driving inputs inspired Emo to do the same, to be consistent and precise behind the wheel himself. And what a great chat. Emerson's account of Montjuic Park 1975 left me open-mouthed at moments, and he gave so many details of what it was like to go racing at the time. Imagine having to take your own doctor to work with you. Just extraordinary. Emerson, thank you for coming on the show again, and I'll see you again soon. Well, that's almost it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. So I'll see you then. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
This is Rob Gronkowski
and Julian Edelman.
We invited some familiar friends to hang out with us at the Boston Nut House, thanks to Dunkin'. Here is a sneak peek at some of the fun.
Vince Wilfork.
Bill Finder, like, look, guys, just stop screwing around.
We are joined by Matthew Light, ladies and gentlemen.
And Vraves. And you're going to love him.
Will Campbell.
Not into eating hot dogs.
Having Ernie Adams come and teach you defense.
Being able to play the wide three technique tackle.
Full episodes of Dudes on Dudes and Games with Names presented by Dunkin'. Tune into iHeart Podcast or wherever you listen to your podcast. Thanks to Dunkin' for a great time.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.